AM 690 WIFC. My name is Eric Asher. Thanks so much for being with us. We're live at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, where they're going to be open for Thanksgiving, folks. That's right. Palace Cafe and Bourbon House will be open all day, serving their signature dishes, as well as traditional Thanksgiving feasts. And, of course, the menus are online at www.palacecafe.com or www.bourbonhouse.com. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse will be open for dinner on Thanksgiving, serving a complete menu, as well as roast turkey with all the fixings. I'm hungry just thinking about it. And, of course, that menu online as well at DickieBrennanSteakhouse.com. We are live at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, 716 Iberville in the quarter. Go all the way until 6 o'clock. Corey Johnson's going to step in 3 to 6. Rick Mueller show from 5 to 6 here in the bar at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse. And I want to thank Joseph Cowell for joining us on the program. We'll bring him back on probably again next week and get a little bit more feel for his platform as he is running for the 2nd Congressional District seat here in New Orleans. But it is my absolute pleasure. And I'm telling you, folks, I am hyped. I was hoping to do this a while back, and our schedules just haven't jived, but one of the best in the business joins me right now live at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse. Ron Nabon, New Orleans, probably New Orleans' best political strategist. Some call him the Kingmaker. I'll call him the Kingmaker. Ron Nabon joins us. Ron, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Ron, thank you so much for being with us. I certainly appreciate it. Ron, let's talk about when you get into a campaign. What attributes does a candidate have to possess to be a winner on the local level first?
Right. Well, there are basic criteria that any campaign, whether or not it's local or national, that you need. One is obviously the candidate. The candidate, his qualifications, his experience, and whether or not that candidate has charisma that will attract voters. The other component you look for is financing. No matter how good you are, if you can't get your message out, finance is important. The next issue is issues. What is position does this candidate take on issues? And a fourth is organization. How do you organize your campaign? How do you get your message out? And I said, no matter at what level, whether or not it's for President of the United States or school board, local school board, those are four different areas that if you're good in all of them, you know, you're going to be successful.
For a newcomer, someone that, especially now, people that want to get into the political system would like to have the opportunity to get involved in public service. You know, some people don't have deep pockets. They don't have that situation. I mean, it helps if you've got deep pockets, but you still have to be able to reach out and fundraise. How big of a deal when you put those things together is fundraising, the ability for the candidate to go out and raise money?
Well, money becomes more important the larger the district you run for. For example, if you're running for a small district like a state legislative House seat, even if you don't have the money, if you're well organized, if you have some charisma, if you're willing to knock on doors, the main purpose of any campaign is to make contact with the voters. So if you don't have money, you need a lot of energy, volunteers, and be willing to knock on the doors of all the registered voters in that district.
From a political strategist standpoint, somebody comes to you, they want to get it, they would like you to take on their campaign. Is it more important for you to agree with the candidate's position, their political philosophy, or maybe the fact that the candidate really has a true shot to win the race? When they approach you, what are the kind of put those things in order?
Right. Well, I'm a little different. I don't consider myself a political pro. So I'm very selective in terms of candidates I represent. I have to believe in a candidate. And so I don't look at representing many candidates during any election cycle. I'll pick one or two at most. And that's because, as I said, I don't consider myself a political pro. I have to believe in a candidate. And by dealing with one or two, I can give that candidate and his family all the attention they need and avoid conflicts, as opposed to the pros who handle, you know, 10, 12, and 14 campaigns at one time.
Does the candidate's philosophy have to jive with your philosophy in order for you to get energized and get behind them?
I never have a litmus test, but I have to believe that the candidate is sincere and truthful. Every campaign is different. And so if, you know, someone who believes that you can't sell candidate like you can sell a bar of soap or buy detergent, people are smarter than that. And if you have a tough race with an equal opponent, people can see through it. So the candidate has to have some substance and be honest in terms of his positions. I don't have to believe in all his positions, but I have to believe at least this person, man or female, you know, is honest.
New Orleans preeminent political strategist Ron Nabon joins us on the program. We're live at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, 716 Iberville in the French Quarter. with that said, obviously you can, look, I'll say it. You're the best in the business, so you can be selective. Does a candidate have to have a true shot to win for you to take it on, or are you willing to take a chance on a candidate that may not have that true shot, but you think in the long run, maybe through hard work, that candidate may have the opportunity to win at the end of the day?
Well, I don't choose a candidate based on winnability. I choose a candidate based on more potential. You know, whether or not that person would, you know, is honest, whether or not the person would be a good public official once he or she is elected. And the truth of the matter is, most times I work with candidates who are long shots.
Right.
In terms of what the polls show and their finances. So, but if the person has potential, if they're honest, if they're hardworking, and they're willing to take some advice and instructions, you know, I'm willing to take that chance with them.
Ron Nabone with us on the mighty 690 AM, 690 WIST. Political organizations here in this city have dominated the political landscape for really going back maybe since the inception of this city. Let's talk about political organizations, both black and white. Are they still able to mobilize voters? Are they still able to mobilize the get-out-the-vote effort 3 years after Katrina? How much has that changed?
Well, it's changed. Let me just first say this, because that's always a question about New Orleans. We have a lot of what they call alphabet soup organizations,
yes,
both black and white. And historically, that's not unique to New Orleans. In America, we've always had political organization, the Tweed organization in New York, and usually are based ethnically. When the Irish first came, they had formed political organization, Italians, and in New Orleans, we had Italian and Irish political organizations early on, and then more recently in the 70s, when African Americans became more politically involved, we had the emergence of black political organizations. And to answer your question specifically, since Katrina, the political landscape in New Orleans has changed. We still have, I guess, the grandfather of political organizations in New Orleans, the RDO, the
yes,
Regular Democratic Organization. And they have been active in New Orleans for a long time. Since in the 70s, when African Americans became more politically involved, and more specifically involved in the Moon Landrieu election, you had the organizations of KU, BO, SO, and those organizations. And later, Congressman Jefferson started a group called Progressive Democrats. And what happened in New Orleans is what happened nationally. The less political involvement an ethnic group or a social group has in government, the more effective those political organizations are. What they do is offer candidates who are part of the city or local government access to their communities. So when the African-American vote became more active, they helped Moon Landrieu win. They helped Moon Landrieu gain access to the black voters. And that was the peak of the power and influence of black organizations before you had black elected officials.
Sure.
But once black elected officials became more common, especially in the mayor's office and the council position, those organizations became less effective because, again, the African-American citizen had access to the elected official, and there was no need for any intermediary.
But there always has been, and even pre-Katrina, that get-out-the-vote effort by those political organizations,
right,
whether it be a situation where they're handing out a hand card,
right,
as people are coming out of church or coming out of a bingo or something like that, or going door-to-door with those cards, or on election day, mobilizing the get-out-the-vote effort, getting people to the polls.
Right.
Are they as effective as they were before Katrina?
Not as before Katrina. For example, they have been part of what you would call the Democratic political apparatus. For example, when for Mary Landrieu and for Governor Blanco, both Mary Landrieu and Blanco came out of New Orleans with 80,000 to 90,000 vote lead, and you know those were close elections.
Yes.
So that's a major motherload of votes. Post Katrina, there's been a dispersal of the African American citizens, and even though there's been some gradual return, most people feel that they are probably somewhere between 75,000 and 80,000 fewer African American votes in a city since Katrina.
In your mind, are those voters now dispersed all over the country? Have they moved to other parts of Louisiana, maybe parishes outside of Orleans right now? What are the numbers showing?
All of the above. Once the citizens of New Orleans were dispersed, they were dispersed all across the country. But over time, as we got further away from September 29th, people tried to get close to home. So a lot of residents who were dispersed tried to get close to home and moved in areas from Baton Rouge, Alexandria, other parts of Louisiana. But also, the further we got away from that disaster, people started putting down roots in other places. So the quest, and then the other problem we had is the recovery. The recovery was slow. The road home to home was a disaster.
Yes.
And a lot of people, for different reasons, did not return to New Orleans. Some may want to come home, but the bottom line is we have fewer voters, especially African-American voters in New Orleans since Katrina.
Political strategist Ron Nabone joins us here at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse on the mighty 690 AM 690 WIST, 504-260-0690, 1-888-880-WIST. A strong voting block, Ron, pre-Katrina was elderly African-Americans. We've had a mayoral election. We've had two congressional elections. We've had a presidential election to gauge the strength of that base. What is that base back 3 years after Katrina?
It's not completely back, but in terms of voter performance, older voters, whether or not they're black, white, yellow, or brown, are always more reliable voters. Younger voters, no matter what ethnic group they belong to, are less reliable. So historically, among the African Americans, the older black voters were more reliable and had a greater turnout record. And not only older voters, but the majority of the voters, when you look at chronic voters, black or white, they're women. So those are the two most reliable demographic groups among really black or white voters in New Orleans and across the country.
Ron, you're a New Orleanian that loves this city. I mean, you've done so much to try to help it on a political level. You're out volunteering. You're getting involved each and every day. If you would, are you encouraged or discouraged by our progress 3 years post-Katrina?
Well, I guess a more accurate description is frustrated. I'm born and raised in New Orleans, spent some time in the military, some time in Washington, D.C. for a while, but spent most of my life in New Orleans and decided after Katrina, and like many other people, especially professionals who had more ability to move, decided to come back to New Orleans. And personally, and I know in talking to folks around the city, there's a lot of frustration in terms of the slow rate of recovery in this town.
As an African American, describe your feelings in last Tuesday as this nation elected its first African American president.
Well, it was one of unbelievable pride. I'm 60 years old, and I've been politically active most of my life, and I know I never thought I would see the day when an African American would be elected president of the United States. In fact, I had a friend who worked with President-elect Obama. He called me about 18 months ago, said, "Look, Ron, this guy is good. He's going to run for president. You know, can you help?" And I thought I'd be putting him off and said, "Look, if he gets the Democratic nomination, call me." Never thinking that he would get past the Democratic nomination. So I was a volunteer in that effort, and I said, especially I think it's gratifying to people like my parents, who even though I grew up at the end of the segregated society, legal segregation, my parents, I said, grew up in the Depression, went through much more segregation than I ever went through, and they never thought they would see that day. So it's a lot of pride, not only in terms of our race, but in terms of our country.
Yes.
Because Barack was not elected with just African-American votes. Only 13% of the vote he received was African-American. So he had to receive and did receive large numbers of white votes, women votes, Hispanic votes. So it was a day of pride for not only our race, but for our country.
With that said, as we look toward a Barack Obama administration, I've talked about on this program many times that despite the liberal voting record of Barack Obama, I feel like he's got to govern from the center to get anything done, whether it's a Republican Congress, a Democratic Congress, or a mixture of the both, obviously with the Blue Dog Democrats that are going to be pretty dominant in Congress in terms of policy issues. What do you see? You're a guy that does this for a living. How do you see a Barack Obama administration and how they will govern in the next 4 years?
Well, I think because of Barack's background and history, he's always been a centrist. I mean, in terms of when he was in the Illinois legislature, when he was in Congress, even as far back to when he was at Harvard Law School, he was a centrist. He was a guy who saw both sides of the issue, and he's uniquely qualified because, again, even though he's the first African-American, his mother was white, and his grandmother was white, so he knows both sides of the story. Said more than anybody else, and he's experienced the white side and the black side. So I know there will be pressure for him to move, and I know he was demonized as being a socialist. But from everything I know about him personally and from what I read about him, he's going to be a centrist, which is important for at this time for this country.
What do you consider his priorities? Obviously, you're not with him. You're not in his cabinet. But obviously, you're a guy that knows his platform but also understands the needs of Americans. What do you consider his priorities?
No doubt about it is the economy. I mean, if we don't get the economy fixed soon, I mean, we're in trouble. And I think that was the major reason why he won the election. It's no accident that he began to move in the polls when this country in September, you know, the bottom fell out on the economy. So the economy is going to be his priority, and that's important to everybody.
Let's talk about race relations, because it seems like we can't get away with it, away from it. I mentioned last week in this very chair last that America's amped up on both sides. You've got African Americans who feel at this point that they have to go out and they have to protect Barack in a lot of cases on talk radio or in conversations. You've got those that have white Americans that in a lot of cases back McCain that have some anger right now. Race relations here in New Orleans, you know, it comes to a head constantly. It seems like either the race card is played or when we get into elections that we're separated in a lot of cases by race on how we vote. Can we ever get past that? Do you see a day where race is not going to be an issue in politics?
Well, I mean, I never thought I would see the day when we had an African-American elected president. So obviously, I think that's an encouragement on all ends. Race will always be an issue, I think, in every campaign. It's how we deal with race and how the reasonable folks in terms of our leaders and community leaders deal with issues and not race. And that's what Obama was about. I mean, there are always attempts to try to raise the race issue, but to his credit, you know, he stuck in terms of issues, in terms of, and when you describe red states and blue states,
yes,
he dealt with philosophies and issues. And again, he was, I guess, uniquely qualified because his parents and grandparents on one side were white, and on the other side they were African.
Really a biracial president.
He is biracial, that's correct.
Ron, with that said, could this be the opening that this country needs to kind of, you said race is always going to be part of it, but it doesn't, that race is not the most dominant issue sometimes in a campaign, especially if Barack Obama's administration can be an effective administration, pull us out of the situation we're in terms of financial crisis and some of the other things that are going on in our country right now?
Well, he definitely has the opportunity to become a model in terms of what we can do despite our racial history and background. I mean, now every young black person being raised, I know when I was growing up, my parents would tell me, stay in school and you can achieve everything. But I never believed it, and my parents did believe it. Now, again, he came from a single-parent family. Now people can tell their children and say, look, this guy made it. He came from a single parent. You know, he can do it. Anybody can do it. And I think that will be an important inspiration for all Americans, and also in terms of how the rest of the world is viewing America in terms of, you know, our theory of a place where anything can happen, and where we lost our leadership in terms of moral leadership in the world, now we have an opportunity to recover that.
He's Ron Nabon. He's political strategist extraordinaire, one of the best in the business here in New Orleans. He is with us live at Dickey Brennan Steakhouse in the French Quarter. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation with Ron Nabon. Don't forget, Corey Johnson's coming up next, 3 to 6. The Rick Mueller Show from 5 to 6 on the Mighty 690. And, of course, lunch just about over. But you can come on down and still enjoy a great drink. Maybe grab a little something to eat down here at Dickey Brennan's at the bar. And if you're looking for a great place to have dinner, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse, 5:30 to 10, they're open with the greatest steaks in the city. And they do it right here at Dickey Brennan Steakhouse. My name is Eric Casher. You're listening to the Mighty 690, AM 690 WIST.
Eric Asher.
We are live at Dickey Brennan Steakhouse, 716 Iberville in the Quarter, where the chef just brought by a couple huge, I don't know, this is incredible. The shrimp are as big as my hand. Looks like we got a little bit of oysters. Ron, this stuff looks pretty good, huh?
It looks good, and I'm sure it is good. It's
great. And we'll be having it in about 20 minutes or so, because we're going to continue our conversation. Ron Nabon is with me, political strategist, and I'll say it. I consider him the kingmaker here in New Orleans, a guy that when he touches a candidate or he gets involved in a candidate's election, normally that guy or that female is the person that is representing whatever district or whatever office they are going for. Well, let's talk a little bit about about the situation in the state capitol right now. The state voted GOP in the presidential election. We have a Republican governor, but when you look at the Louisiana legislature right now, dominated by Democrats, but kind of mirrors what's going on in Washington in Congress, because we got some blue dog Democrats that can get with the Republican voting bloc and can kind of control what's going on in the legislature. So give me your impressions of this Louisiana legislature from a political standpoint.
Well, obviously when Governor Gendo won in the fashion he did, he wielded a lot of control, okay? But we have yet to see in the next regular session or special session when it comes up what residual effect it will be in the legislature in terms of the relationship between the legislature and the governor after all the tensions involving the pay raise.
Yes.
Obviously, Gendo is still a very popular governor. But that relationship will be tested, and it remains to be seen exactly what the relationship will be between the legislature and Gendo next session.
How much is the relationship between the legislature and the governor now going to affect the way he can govern for the next 3 or so years? But more importantly, if he's got his eyes on the White House, how will that affect his possible run in 2012?
Well, I think if he's going to run for president, he's an ambitious guy, and obviously he said he's more concerned right now about governor state, and I think that's true. He is more concerned, because I think for him to be successful in running for president, he needs to be able to show, look what I did with Louisiana, and if I can do this in Louisiana, I can do this for the rest of the country. So it's important to him to be successful in Louisiana first, and I believe him when he says he's got to spend his time dealing with Louisiana first.
Independent voters in terms of people that are registering in Louisiana, it's non-party. It's the biggest base that is growing as of right now.
Right.
Look into your crystal ball in the future. Is this going to be a situation in Louisiana where we really could end up with a three-party system where we have Republicans, Democrats, and then there's that block of independent voters out there that have to be appeased?
Well, I think in terms of registration, over the past 2 years, the biggest growth has been among independents. And I think in the future you'll see people register as independent, but I don't think we're going to have a strong independent party. I mean, the way our country is built, it's a two-party system, and it's very difficult to have a sustainable third party. So I think you'll see the growth in terms of numbers of independent voters, but it will still be Republican and Democrat.
Ron, elections come around. Big business for TV, radio, newspaper, because obviously there's a lot of money that goes from campaign coffers into advertising that candidate or that platform. One of the things that I hate about election time is attack ads. Talk about attack ads in terms of television commercials and mailers and the effectiveness of those attack ads.
Right. Well, attack ads are always controversial. I mean, if you talk to or poll voters, they will say, look, everybody will say, I don't like attack ads, and I don't react to them. The truth of the matter is, attack ads are an important part of any campaign, and you have two types of attack campaigns. I always say there's a difference between running an aggressive campaign where you attack somebody on a public record as opposed to mudslinging where you bring in things, hearsay, unsubstantiated things, and not based on fact. So there's a difference. But attack ads, even though most people say they don't pay attention to them, they do. And candidates will use attack ads for one of several reasons. One is, if they're behind a candidate in terms of numbers, they will try to bring up some things, factual or non-factual, let's say between the difference between aggressive and non-and dirty, to let people know this is not the guy or person you're voting for, to cast some doubt on that person. Another purpose or effect of attack ads is also to diminish the turnout, because if you get in a real messy campaign and people are frustrated and tired of the attack ads going back and forth, people may not vote, okay? And that may be something that the person attacking may want, a lower turnout. In the last weeks of the presidential campaign, for example, when voters were asked about who do you think is doing the most attack ads, it's no accident that they thought that the McCain campaign was doing more attack ads than Obama campaign.
Placement and timing of those attack ads, and more importantly, a rebuttal on an attack ad. How critical?
Well, timing is always crucial in any campaign. If the campaign is along as it was over the presidential campaign, the timing is you have to do it at the crucial time when it's going to affect the outcome of the election. A lot of times people will, if the race is close, they may not attack until late in the campaign, to limit the response to the other candidate, so it may be late. But the timing is crucial, and it depends on where you are in the polls in terms of when you start your attack. Because if you're too far back, you can't wait too late in the campaign.
Right, and again, if somebody sends out a mailer or has an attack ad at that 11th hour, it's difficult to come back and rebut that.
That's correct.
You know, so the timing and placement obviously very critical for a campaign on how they're going to attack and to giving that opponent an opportunity to respond.
And that's the traditional view, but the nature of elections is changing in this country. More and more we're getting to early voting now. We used to call it absentee voting, but we have mail-in voting, we have early voting, and some states like Oregon, for example, the vote starts 30 days before the election.
That's amazing.
So you miss a lot of voters if you wait too late.
Yes.
To either make yourself known or to make the negatives of your opponent
known.
So
it's a changing landscape.
It is a changing landscape in terms of our election process.
Well, let me throw some names out at you, and if you would, just give me your impressions. William Jefferson is obviously beat Helena Moreno, has really carried the black constituents here in New Orleans, a strong base which has stood behind William Jefferson, even with all the things that are swirling around him. If you would, give me your impressions of William Jefferson and his opportunity to get reelected.
Okay. First of all, I got to have disclosure. I mean, I'm a personal friend of Jefferson and his friend. I mean, in his family, okay?
Sure.
And have been since we took the bar together, and he was a law clerk in federal court. Having said that, when I think of my friend Bill Jefferson, I think of tragedy. He's without doubt one of the most talented people in the state and the country. And it's unfortunate that he got in the legal troubles he did. I said, hopefully everything will turn out, you know, best, whatever best means for him and his family. So he has a lot of talent. And in this race, most recently, I know a lot of friends in New Orleans and around the country said, well, what are you guys doing reelecting a guy who's under indictment? All his family seems to be under indictment. And, again, that's difficult to say. I guess the explanation I get, and I say, is that in his last closed primary election when Bill Jefferson ran, 75% of the voters who voted for somebody other than Bill Jefferson, okay? So he was lucky in a sense that he got in a runoff with someone like Ms. Moreno.
Right.
And people will say, well, you know, I said he won because of race. I always counter that and said, look, in the primary, a lot of white voters who voted for Moreno, that's
yep.
how she got in the runoff,
sure.
a lot of white voters had an opportunity to vote for a qualified African-American
right.
candidate.
Go didn't. Right down the line.
So I guess, you know, the race vote works
sure.
both ways. And again, if you know, it's a big if, and I said if big ifs are always big, but in terms of Moreno, it was a question of somebody who had the talent and experience versus somebody who didn't have that, and to be honest, was not well known, even though she was on TV. So people usually vote for people that they know, even if there are big question marks over that person at the time.
With that said, Joseph Cow is the Republican candidate that's going to be running in the general election on December 6th against William Jefferson. There are some other candidates, Green Party, etc. But kind of the same scenario here with Joseph Cao, who doesn't have a lot of name recognition, probably has that strong Vietnamese base,
mm-hmm.
but now has to woo black voters.
Right.
What do you see?
Well, I suspect the strategy of the Cao campaign is based on turnout. I mean, Jefferson is lucky politically because we had Gustav, the storm, that pushed back the Democratic primary to Super Tuesday. And so he had a heavy black turnout, and he won on the coattails of Obama on Tuesday, November 4th. I'm sure the Republicans and Mr. Kyle are looking at a strategy where there will be a substantially less turnout among all voters, especially black turnout. So if I'm looking at them, they would be looking at, say, how can we activate and motivate the Republican Party and the whites and any independent African Americans who are chronic voters and get them to vote when Jefferson's strongest base will not sleepy like him, but are not likely to vote. So the turnout will probably drop anywhere from around 72% to maybe 10%.
Let's talk about U.S. Senator David Vitter. He's obviously had some problems. He's coming up for election in, I believe, 2010. Got about a couple years now for him to try to solidify his base. Can he overcome all the distractions from the D.C. madam, some of the situations that have been publicized here in New Orleans to be reelected statewide?
Personally, I think he can. I mean, he's another talented person who had some, you know, personal problems, and I think he will probably be reelected depending on who the Democrats put up to face him. what happened, I think, with Senator Bitter is that he hurt, if not destroyed, his chance of becoming president. He was another one, I think, who expressed to some of his friends that he had ambition to be U.S. president, and he could have been. But I think those goals now are dead, but I think he will be reelected U.S. Senator.
Ron Nabon, political strategist, joins us on the mighty 690 AM, 690 WIST. We're live at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, 716 Iberville in the Quarter. We'll be here until 6 o'clock tonight. Corey Johnson takes over at 3. The Rick Mueller Show between 5 and 6. Come on out and join us. Dinner starts at 5:30, goes all the way until 10 o'clock tonight. John Kennedy ran a pretty decent race against Mary Landrieu, but what do you think were the factors on why John Kennedy couldn't overtake Mary Landrieu?
Well, I think the Republicans, in terms of challenging Senator Landrieu, have never put up the strongest possible candidate they could. I thought Secretary of State Darden would have been a much stronger candidate and may have won. Kennedy, obviously, he had the issue of flip-flopping.
Right.
You know, he was considered, when he ran for Senate one time, he was a Democrat, and he flip-flopped not only in terms of party, but on issues. And the Landrieu campaign took advantage of that. So I think even despite those problems for Kennedy, it was still closer than a lot of people thought.
Your impressions of the Nagin administration post-Katrina?
Again, frustration, in a sense, both personally and in terms of our community. A lot of hope in terms of Mayor Nagin on his reelection after Katrina. And he has a lot of charisma. I don't think he's developed his potential. And one thing that I think the city lacked, and is, you know, you often hear about leadership.
Yes.
And leadership is not, you know, necessarily doing the right thing, but doing something and communicating to the public and giving the public confidence. And I think he's failed in terms of communicating with the population and giving people confidence in terms of how we're going to get out of this mess we're in and how we're going to get out through this recovery period.
I guess when I look at leadership also, I look at someone that has to make the tough decisions. Not the popular decisions, but the tough decisions. And I think that's been one of the things that the Nagin administration has not done effectively for us post-Katrina. Can you give me your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I have a view of leadership based in terms of my experience in the military.
Sure.
As an infantry officer, I mean, they have to have confidence in you, and if you're in a tough situation, and the military is tough, this is that, you know, life is on the line, you have to make tough decisions in terms of how you're going to protect your men and get them out of trouble. I don't think the mayor has done that. And so I said I'm more disappointed and frustrated in terms of opportunities he had to become a leader.
Let's talk about the next mayoral election here in New Orleans. Obviously, at this point, it is fairly wide open. You won't have an incumbent running. Give me your thoughts on some of the potential candidates out there and who might be the next mayor of the city of New Orleans.
Well, what I'll do is I'll give you a list of names that have been floating around. The two at the top of the list, depending on if they run, because none of them have actually declared. Mitch Landrieu ran a good race last time, was unsuccessful. The question is whether or not he wants to become mayor.
Do you think he does?
I'm not sure. Okay, I know all the polls, several polls taken show that he could become mayor if he ran, but I'm not sure he wants to run. Councilman at large Arnie Philco is another one who's shown up well in the early polls and has some broad based support financially and politically. John Georges, who ran for governor and spent almost $11 million of his own money.
Wow.
If he ran for mayor, obviously he would be well-financed and has some name recognition. He would be a major candidate. Councilperson at large, Jackie Clarkson, who ran in for council at large when Arnie Philco ran. And she's the president of the council now. She's been active, and some people say she's always had ambitions to be mayor. Some other candidates, James Carter on a city council from District C. It's interesting to see if he will run and what effect his loss, his embarrassing loss under performance would have on his...
In the second congressional district.
In the second congressional district. He ran and came in, I think, fifth. But before that, he was considered, you know, a possible candidate for mayor. Representative Badon from the Ninth Ward, his name has been mentioned. Senator Ed Murray, his name has been mentioned. Roy Glapion, businessman, his name has been mentioned.
Yes.
So those are names I've heard in terms of possible candidates for mayor.
It's been since 1978 that New Orleans has had a white mayor. Can we get past the racial divisions in this city and elect a white man?
Well, I mean, I think so. And just recently, there was a thought before Katrina that we would never have another white elected citywide official in the city. Obviously, post-Katrina, the landscape has changed. Just this past November 4th, we had two white candidates for DA, and obviously we have a white DA. The voting patterns in New Orleans right now are about 50-50. So I think it's possible that, and maybe some people think probable, that we'll have a white mayor.
Ron Nabon, political strategist, joins us on New Orleans Real Talk, AM 690 WIST. Redistricting's coming down the pike, obviously, with the new census. How will that affect New Orleans, it's particularly the 2nd Congressional District, which has been basically known as an African-American district?
Well, I think you're going to see the redistricting after the 2010 population affect the entire state of Louisiana. Even before Katrina, we were our demographics, we weren't going as fast as other states, so we were likely to lose one of our congressional seats. And after Katrina, it's even more likely and probable that we'll lose a congressional seat. And what will happen is New Orleans will lose a lot of state legislators, and all of the seats from the council to 2nd Congressional District will be expanded. I suspect that because there will be an effort to create at least one minority seat in a state, the 2nd Congressional District, the focus of power will shift from New Orleans to Jefferson Parish, West Bank, and along the River Parish is going towards Baton Rouge.
I agree 100%. I think it. I really believe that it's exactly what it's going to do. It's going to gerrymander all the way up the River Parish on the West Bank, all the way up to Baton Rouge. I agree with you there. Before I let you go, a couple quick questions I did want to ask. Number one, do you think we'll ever see regionalization in our lifetime here in New Orleans? I mean, and we've got these political fiefdoms. I thought we'd get through it after Katrina.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the movement that I hoped that we'd seen.
Right.
You're in the trenches. You see this all the time, dealing with candidates, dealing with people that are involved in politics. Give me your thoughts.
Well, I think we'll see not necessarily regional government, but more regional cooperation out of necessity. For example, flood protection, drainage. I mean, those things know no boundary, and I think out of necessity you're going to see our metropolitan parishes cooperating. The same thing in terms of perhaps public safety, crime fighting, training our law enforcement and first responders. So I think in the next years, out of necessity, we'll see more regional cooperation, not necessarily regional governance.
Last question for you. Vice President Arne Filko is in Chicago today. He is meeting with officials in Chicago about the privatization of their airports in Chicago and maybe looking at the opportunity to do that here in New Orleans. There was a talk about the possibility to transfer the airport from city control to state control. There are some problems with that in terms of the FAA. The city may not want to let that go. Give me your thoughts about privatization.
Well, privatization, I think, is a new growing option for all city governments. In Illinois, for example, they've privatized not only their airport, but also their lottery and roads. So privatization is a way to get funds for city strap like New Orleans, and also to bring in a regional governance to the airport as well.
So you think it's a pretty good idea?
I think it is, yes. It's better than an actual takeover by the state, because I think you can accomplish the objectives without creating unnecessary friction and issues.
Ron, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It is absolutely my pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
You know, I'm a huge fan of yours.
I'm a fan of yours as well.
And I really thank you for taking the time with me.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's Ron Nabon, political strategist. Join us on the Mighty 690 AM 690 WIST. Quick break, and I get to do my favorite thing. Well, I get to eat, and I get to talk to the chefs. Coming up next, my good friend Al Singleton from the Ninth Ward. He's the sous chef over here at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse. He's going to sit in with me. And Ron's going to have his seafood plate. Also, we're going to have a talk with the head chef over here, Chef Martinez, as well. You're listening to the Mighty 690 AM 690 WIST. I just love Thursdays. Look forward to coming on down to Dickie Brennan Steakhouse. Enjoy some of the great food down here, the ambiance. Grab myself a little bit of a cocktail when we finish up. And I got the guys to make it all happen. I got Chef Martinez and my man, sous chef Al Singleton is in. Oh, should I call you Alfred?
You can call.
Just call you.
Yeah,
just call.
Just call me. Don't call Collect, though.
There you go. I'm not calling Collect. I'm paying the bill. I'm paying the bill. Guys, welcome. And once again, knocking it out the park. Great lunch crowd again, as always. And you had the shrimp guy out there. I'm about to eat this shrimp as soon as we get out of here. First of all, thanks again for being with us. Tell us a little bit about what's going on here at Dickie Brennan's.
Man, there's so much going on here right now. We're real excited about lunch. You know, lunch is back, getting back into the swing of things, and you know, me and Chef Jack are working real hard to get the locals, to get them in here, man. Let them know that you can come here and enjoy lunch and enjoy what we have. You know, fresh beef, nice seafood, nice produce. Just come in and have a great time when we're here.
And Chef, one of the beautiful things is both of you guys get together, put your heads together, and create some of these great dishes. You're not afraid to experiment, are you?
Oh, no, not at all. We always try to have fun. Like this morning, I came this morning, and Chef Walter is playing with a little bit of the appetizers that we have in there, and we are tasting and putting together and platters and stuff like that. We have a party of 25, and they have different wines, and we're just trying, you know, to explore and have fun with food. You know, share with that with our customers, and that's the beauty of the whole thing, you know, just getting here, something fresh, something nice, as you see this morning when the shrimp guys that's the reason I went. I got the big shrimp to you, so like that's what you want to have for lunch.
They were huge and I'm not kidding, folks, as big as my hand. Okay, that's how big the shrimps were, as big as my hand. You know, one of the great things about coming to any one of the Dickie Brennan family of restaurants, obviously, is the great food, the ambiance, but also just to celebrate. You guys got rooms in which people can come in and have a celebration, a meeting. But there's going to be a little celebration here on the 21st of November where folks can come in and get a little taste of New Orleans and also do it at a great price as well. Talk a little bit about it.
Well, November 21st, we'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary of Dickie Brennan Steakhouse opening up. What we'll be doing is we'll be offering a $10 bottle of Dickie Brennan Cabernet to every table. And also, we've created a $19.98 entree,
very nice,
which is a black and prime rib.
Black and prime rib for under 20 bucks.
Right, that we'll be serving. And, you know, just... You know, it's 10 years, so we got a $10 bottle of wine, and the year was 1998, so we figured we'll just implement a $19.98 entree. You know, prime rib, you know, the best prime rib you can find, and you know, we got great accompaniments with it, and, you know, it's just going to be a wonderful time. We got it.
And not just that. Unfortunately, you guys, y'all going to be able to eat. I know y'all going to be able to eat on Thanksgiving, but y'all going to be working as well. Going to be taking care of New Orleanians. And those that have come from outside the city to enjoy our great city during Thanksgiving, I can't think of. Look, I love my mama's oyster dressing, okay? And then nothing better than a little baked macaroni and cheese along with a big old turkey on Thanksgiving. But you know what? If I had the opportunity, and I know my wife would like this, the opportunity not to have to cook, but to come down and let you two guys cook for us, that would be a fantastic event. Thanksgiving dinner at the Dickie Brennan family of restaurants, obviously it's going to be on, isn't it?
It's definitely going to be a great time. That's exactly what we do. You know, and from a kitchen standpoint, you know, for the chefs that's working, we have a tradition here at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse that, you know, before service, the entire staff, we get together, and us as chefs, we feed those and the staff, and we sit down and eat with them. And after that, we feed the guests. You know, we have a great menu that we've put in place. You know, for $28, you can come in and get four courses of food. We're starting off with a smoked turkey and andouille sausage gumbo. You can get a choice of a salad. We have a house salad with your choice of dressing. And then we're going to do a roasted turkey dish, which is going to be, you know, boneless turkey. You're going to have white and dark meat. We're going to do oyster cornbread dressing. That's going to be mashed potatoes. That's going to be giblet gravy. You know, we're going to have a house-made cranberry compote that we're going to make with it as well. And just to cap it off, you know, our pastry chef, Stephanie Bernard, she's making these wonderful pumpkin crème brûlées that, you know, we're going to feature with. That's going to be served with this house-made pecan brittle. So, you know, we
and the marshmallow.
Yeah, and
don't forget about that marshmallow.
Homemade marshmallows as well. So we definitely
homemade,
yeah,
marshmallows?
Homemade marshmallows.
Homemade marshmallows.
How do you make a homemade marshmallow? Somebody tell me. No, you can't tell me.
it's a secret, but we're definitely going to be celebrating real big over here. And you know, if there's any families that's out there and you guys don't feel like cooking, just come in to Dickie Brenner Steakhouse and let us do all the work for you.
There you go.
And we guarantee you'll have a great experience, a great family time, and some great food to share with that as well.
And of course, Wednesday through Friday, lunch from 11:30 to 2:30. Great lunch specials, right, Chef Jack?
Yes, sir. Everything fresh. You know, we have different prices for different people. We have everything, like you said, different rooms. There's something but really appetite that is so fresh. You know, seafood is fresh. All our beef is prime. We have a great place, great salads. You know, great soup.
Yes.
I'm not really sure if you take the soup today, but it's wonderful. Well, we have another one.
Guess what?
In there.
My time's up. I'm about to go taste everything you've got in that kitchen coming up next. Chef Jack Martinez, Chef Alfred Singleton from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. We'll see you again. We'll see you again next week for sure.
All right.
Hey, folks, it's been an absolute fabulous time here at Dickie Brennan's. I want to thank Jerry, who's been taking care of me each and every time here at Dickie Brennan Steakhouse. Also want to thank Craig DeFaro, Lee Zurich, Ron Nabon, also Joseph Chow for joining us as well. I'll